Law Focus Podcast, bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
Welcome to Law Focus. My name is Veronica Mahwadi, your voice of law for the evening, right here on VAW FM 88.1. Like every Tuesday evening, right here on VAW FM, from 7 p.m. till 8 p.m, we will unpack everything law related. South Africa's Bill of Rights speaks highly of equality as an entrenched fundamental right. Hence, we have our equality clause in Section 9 of the Constitution. Other laws that speak to equality include the promotion of equality and prevention of unfair discrimination, as well as the provision of labor relations and the Employment Equity Act. The reality of the life of an HIV-positive person is that access to progressive treatment, fairness in the workplace, and the right to privacy are still issues of daily struggle and discrimination for them. Tonight's show will look into issues of human rights in relation to HIV criminalization and disclosure. And of course, to help us to navigate this discussion, we will be in conversation with HIV/AIDS expert Dr. Cindy van Zyl, as well as attorney of healthcare and life science law Neil Kirby. Of course, this wouldn't be a conversation without your input. If you do wish to join the show, you can send us a tweet at VAWFM using the hashtag LawFocus. You can also send us a voice note on our WhatsApp line using the number 084-078-4912. Please do stay tuned for the upcoming discussion. But before we get into that, we start the show with the legal hotspots of the week. Here are your legal hotspots.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week, it's Legal Hotspots.
I'm joined in studio by one of our Law Focus researchers, Siyabonga Mota, who will be giving us our legal hotspots for the evening. What do you have for us, Sia?
Well, we'll start with Caster Semenya, where she went to the Court of Arbitration for Sport on Monday to challenge proposed rules that could force her to lower her hormone levels. So the International Association of Athletes Federation says it is introducing the rules to create a level of playing field for other female athletes. Mm. So this comes after she's like this, basically saying she should reduce her hormone level so that she can, if she still wants to compete, because they feel like she's, I mean, stronger than other women, if I may put it like that. The measures would force so-called hypertrogenic athletes or those with different differences of sexual development to take drugs to lower their hormone levels below a prescribed amount if they wish.
That is absurd. I know you can see me from across the table shaking my head. That is just crazy.
Yeah, so I mean, the South African government says the rules specifically target Semenya and they are violating her human rights.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's also just speaking to a bigger, you know, problem.
Yeah.
Are we now speaking about the standard of in which women can compete in certain spaces? What are we now saying, that women must be a certain way to be considered a woman? I mean, it's very tricky, and it's honestly quite, you know, disrespectful.
You know, for me, would go if we were to make an example with a man who had like low hormone levels, like
Correct.
If it's a low. So for him to compete with other men, he should obviously
now be, you know, pumped with estrogen or testosterone. Yeah.
So that's the biggest question that I have.
I mean, why?
Thinking about it now, that.
What was wrong with Usain Bolt? Why didn't they put him on drugs?
Yeah, why didn't they say, no, he's too strong for the other men? So
yeah, he's too fast, you know, all that Jamaican blood. Slow it down. No.
So it raises the question against women in sports.
No, absolutely.
It raises a big question that are women being targeted because of their
ability to compete.
Ability to compete, of course.
Ability to be the best, to be champions.
Yeah, so I'm with, we have to look into this, like,
no,
and
definitely.
Check.
Definitely. And I think as a country, we are definitely all behind and we are all supporting her.
Yeah, so the rules were to be introduced last year in November, but they have been put on hold because this is, it's been like going on for some time. So, the past weekend, there were hearings. So a judgment is expected by the end of March this year. So moving to our second story, talking about the R&B artist whose legal name is Robert Sylvester Kelly, who was charged on Friday with 10 counts of criminal sexual abuse. So this is obvious. We know Mr. Step in the Name of Love, that guy. Now he's facing charges that, you know, have been happening, that took place years ago.
And so, it's about time. And You know, my only worry about this situation with him facing charges is that he's been in the situation before where he's faced charges and
he was arrested.
But he's still here. He's still making music.
And it's confusing in a way because now some people saying, why are they coming out now? Why? But it happened. We have to face it.
And it could still be happening. So yeah. let's just hear more about the story.
So he turned himself in on the same day, although he denies the charges and all the allegations against him. So he's not saying, yes, I did it. He's like, no, I'm going to challenge this because now he's denying it.
Which is nothing new, once again.
Of course. So according to the Cork County State Attorney, Kimberly Fox, three of the four victims were between the ages of 13 and 17 at the time of the alleged abuse, which is said to be back in 1998.
Mm.
So that is like 21 years ago.
Mm.
And he is scheduled for a March 8 arraignment where he'll have an opportunity to enter into a plea. So it's kind of, we're building up to that. As in like few days from now, it's going to be taking place. So moving to our last story, suing because of masturbation. That's the last story. So a set of 54-year-old conjoined twins from Michigan are facing each other in a legal battle as one of the siblings is contesting his brother's right to engage in sexual acts without his permission. As I can see your face now, you're like, okay.
I am trying to obviously put this in perspective. Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, Alfred and Wilbert Peterson were born joined and the way at the waist basically, and facing each other. So just think about it when we talk about sex and with a set of twins who were born in their condition. So
great.
Now they're contesting, they're having a battle of the one is like contesting a sexual act, like he wants to
be able to
have sex without his brother's permission.
Right, because they are now obviously sharing one organ.
Yeah, so
very tricky, very
very very tricky. So this shared penis has caused many fights between the twins over recent years, and Alfred is now going to court to stop his brother from masturbating.
I mean, I have to pause this because, I mean, personally, I can't relate.
Yeah.
So I have to ask you as a gentleman, if you had a twin brother stuck to your hip, you know, and he found that, you know what, I want to masturbate, but you don't, would you take him to court? How would you guys settle this?
Yeah, I think to engage in any sexual...
Because it does require your consent. I mean, you guys are sharing the same organ.
No, in their condition, I think they should try to work something out, you know. They should try to work something out because now they are stuck to each other together forever, I mean. So obviously, if one of them wants sexual pleasure, they should like tolerate each other, if I may put it like that. They should find a way of working this out, if I may put it like that. So going to court... Yeah.
Might not be the best situation.
It might not, because the court might judge something, might come up with a verdict, but one of them will like, I can't follow this. This person, we are together. I can't.
And isn't it, if I'm suing you, I'm also technically suing myself, in a way.
In a way, if one of them were to be convicted,
correct,
both of them would go to jail.
Very, very tricky, but it is very interesting when it comes to
this is an unusual case, you know, because it is said to clarify many legal issues concerning the sexuality of conjoined twins. And it's something that we don't talk about.
And it's something we don't talk about.
Yeah,
we don't
talk
about it. This is the amazing thing about law, is that it really opens our eyes to various things that we just really try not to think about, but it kind of forces us and says, what do we do in these situations?
Yeah. And I think it's time for us to just open up the law. Like the law community basically should open up cases that affect things that we don't even talk about.
Correct.
So is basically something that's, I wouldn't say hidden, but something that's not common to our everyday life.
Yeah, and in our mainstream media.
So,
course, this is why we do have legal hotspots. And
yes,
this is the kind of stories that Sia brings for us to sort of engage in. Thank you so much, Sia. Much appreciated. You are still tuned into Law Focus on VAR FM 88.1. Let's continue with the show as we discuss HIV AIDS and the law.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week. It's Legal Hotspots.
We asked for your opinion this week on whether or not someone should be criminalized for transmitting or exposing another person to HIV intentionally or unintentionally. And this is what you had to say.
No. Fitness and wellness, for instance, is your own health and responsibility. So if you go get HIV from wherever you get it from, it's your responsibility as well. So no one should be criminalized for doing so. If, for instance, if I have to have sex with a girl, I need to know my status. I need to know her status. If I decide on not knowing her status and I decide to go flesh on flesh with her and get and contract an HIV, who's to blame? Myself. No one should be criminalized on that.
It depends whether it's intentionally or unintentionally. If it's intentionally, yes, because you're stealing someone's life. If it's unintentionally, there are ways to go about preventing it. So with the disease or the virus itself takes 3 working days or 3 days in itself to cultivate in your bloodstream. So if you take ARVs for a month, you can avoid it completely.
They should be criminalized, especially if they know. Because when you know, it's like you are spreading it on purpose, man. You go, okay, and I give it to the next one and the next one. Yeah, but even nama STD, nama STI. When you know, there should be some sort of law, maybe. You know, if you knew your status before you engaged and you didn't use protection, then... Because, I mean, for instance, HIV, it's a lifetime virus. They still haven't found a cure. So if manje uzo infect omunye umuntu ni virus, and then kusasa you come back with, I don't know, or even if you knew it, it's a thing, yokuthi ya, yabona, umuntu wami or what's or not.
It's really both of us, like, we're really responsible if... I'm being intimate with you, like, willingly, you're not forcing to sleep with me, and without a condom on top of it, and HIV positive, but then you didn't disclose your status with me, then it's my responsibility too, if I'm infected. It means I gave you my body willingly, you didn't force me anything. It's not a criminal offense, but then if you forced to sleep with me, then that's something else.
I don't think anyone should be criminalized, because either it's intentional or unintentional, you knew what you were getting yourself into when you had unprotected sex. So the chances are, when you have unprotected sex, even if you don't know if a person has the disease, you may get or may not. So you just risked your life, your own life. No one should be criminalized.
I don't think they should be criminalized, because both parties would have agreed to be involved in a sexual intercourse. So I don't think we should blame one person.
I think yes, because especially if it wasn't communicated, if talks weren't had before the intercourse happened that I'm positive and the person receiving the virus consented, if anyone would, then it should be criminalized.
Like, uzobuwazi ukuthi une HIV, uzova abanye abantu.
Southern Africa has the highest HIV prevalence, with Swaziland ranked in at first place, followed by Botswana, Lesotho, South Africa, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Mozambique, and then Malawi. South Africa currently has a population of 57 million people. Of these, approximately 7 million are HIV positive. That is 13.1% of the population. In fact, statistics also show that 18.8% of HIV positive persons are aged between 15 to 49, which of course is the reproductive age. The Firth South African National HIV Prevalence Incidence Behavior and Communication Survey revealed that 26.3% of HIV-positive persons are female, whereas 14.8% are males. Further, 16.6% are black, followed by coloured, white and Asian Indians. Of course, as we try to understand the state of HIV in South Africa, our researcher Millicent Ndwene spoke to an HIV-AIDS expert, Dr. Cindy van Zyl.
We are now joined on the line by HIV-AIDS expert, Dr. Cindy van Zyl. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Cindy. Welcome to Law Focus.
Thank you so much.
Now, Southern Africa has the highest number of HIV prevalence in the world. Swaziland is literally sitting as almost 30% of its entire population. We, together with our neighboring countries, are trailing closely behind. What is it about Southern Africa, Southern Africans, or is it just our geography? What is it about us that we have to have such a high HIV prevalence?
So... you know, whenever I'm asked this question, the one thing that people don't realize is that the breaking up of the family units contributed a great deal
to just, you know, people living apart from their partners and so on. And apartheid is a very good example of that. And if you look at the at migrant labor, how you'll have, you know, one partner in another province and another partner working elsewhere, and then you end up having people with multiple families. So that culture, which is imposed on us, has contributed greatly to the spread of HIV in our region.
That's
I think over the years, the infection rate is coming down slightly, but we still do carry the highest burden, as you say, in the world.
Well, that's an interesting, you know, answer that I wasn't aware that, you know, some of the contributions are because of this history.
And the reason I say this is because if you look at the coloured community, right, the coloured community has a very high rate of teenage pregnancies, but a very, very low rate of HIV, right? And so when you dig deeper and you look at all the different racial groups, you find that the other racial groups the families were not split apart, right? So the white people, the Indian people, and the colored people tend to be family units, and the black people tend to be scattered, more scattered. And if you put a man in Mpumalanga to go and mine coal, and his wife is in KZN, you know, you are basically asking, you're creating a recipe for trouble. There's no two ways about it.
That's very informative.
Yeah.
That's very informative. Now, who should go for HIV testing?
Look, I feel that as soon as you become sexually active, you should go for an HIV test at least once a year. And I say this because many times I see couples where one couple is negative and one couple is positive, and they're now trying to figure out from me when the infection may have happened. But if you've never tested for HIV before, and the first time I see you is in this scenario where one is negative and one is positive, I have no way of knowing when and how anything may have happened. So it should become a habit for all of us who are sexually active to test for HIV. And even if you've been sexually active in the past, you should have a baseline HIV test. Even more important is that before you embark on a sexual relationship with someone, while you're still in the dating phase, because, you know, sometimes you can tell when a relationship is going somewhere. I mean, if a guy asks you out for coffee the first time, the second time, the third time, then you know that you're not brother and sister. He's going somewhere, right? So it's the conversation around sex should start then. I mean, you can feel when someone is vibing with you.
Yeah.
So just simple questions like, have you ever had an HIV test? Simple questions like, what do you think of condoms? I mean, you don't want to find out that someone doesn't like condoms when you're already naked and in bed. That's
sure.
That's the worst that's place dangerous. To find out. Exactly.
And what
many
about
people get caught out in that situation.
Yeah. What about people then who are not sexually active? Is it something that is important to do? For instance, maybe for the statistics, is it something that actually matters if I've never had sex in my life to actually still just go for the HIV testing?
No, I think so. I think if you're of age, excuse me, and you've never had sex in your life, you just want to have a baseline HIV test. Just do a test, and then you can keep it somewhere. So you know that, okay, I'm negative, and then at least you know your status.
Yeah.
And you can carry on with your life. But I think South Africa is a very interesting country in that even though we have the highest rate of HIV, we don't speak about sex openly, right? We all know that HIV is there. We all know what needs to be done. But we don't talk about sex. And how can you talk about HIV all the time and not speak about sex? So, yeah, we're a strange country.
We really are. Now, is it possible to really know who it is that might have infected you with HIV?
So the only way you can know is if you've been testing regularly. So say, for example, you test every 6 months without fail. You test every January, and then you test again every June, every January, every June. When you do test positive, you know exactly who you've been having sexual relationships with, you can then trace back and say, oh, okay, I was negative in June, more January I was positive, and the only person I've had unprotected sex with is Cindy. Mm-hmm. Then you can say it to Cindy. But in the absence of regular HIV tests and a recent HIV negative test, it's impossible to tell. You can guess, but guessing, you know, doesn't work.
Well, I hope we are going to actually apply some of these things that you're really telling us, because it's important. And, you know, in the event of certified mentally ill patients,
yes,
there's issues of consent to HIV testing as well.
Yes.
How does it work for them?
Okay, so the only time that you can get an HIV test done on someone is if a court has ordered it Okay, so being mentally ill is not a justification for a forced HIV test. Mm. I think the only time that I've seen an HIV test being forced on someone is if there's been a sexual assault, and the person that has done the sexual assault, we need to know the status. In that situation, the court will order that an HIV test be done so that we can take the necessary action.
Is that regarded as an emergency?
Yes, definitely. I mean, look, in any case, we're going to put the sexual assault victim on post-exposure prophylaxis and all the necessary medication. But in my time as a medical student and as a doctor, the only time I saw a test being forced on someone was during a sexual assault case where the person that did the sexual assault was forced to do a test.
Okay. Yeah. Now, since ARVs were introduced, I'm not a medical doctor, so some of my terms are going to fail me. South Africa has using
efavirenz. Yes.
Yeah, no. And more recently, the Dolutegravir, how do we pronounce that one?
Dolutegravir
has been said to be introduced. What is the difference between these two ARVs?
Okay, so whenever we treat HIV, with three or more drugs. Okay, so there's always three or more drugs, and efavirenz and dolutegravir are the third drug which we'd introduce to treat HIV. So the problem with efavirenz is that it's a very good drug; it works really well, but it causes some side effects like dizziness, it causes headaches, in some people it causes nausea, and in some people it causes nightmares. So for the most part, most people only have those side effects for like 2 weeks and then they're fine. But there's some people where the side effects persist and they don't get better. And so what we realized that, okay, if then a newer drug came along. There's a lot of newer drugs, and dolutegravir happens to be the one that's on everyone's lips because, you know, it's a new drug, it's a new kid on the block. But so when dolutegravir came along, we felt that, okay, for a country, dolutegravir can work well as a replacement for efavirenz because almost everyone at the moment is on two drugs plus the efavirenz, okay? So then unfortunately what happened is that in Botswana, where they introduced the drug, and what happened is that four babies were born with some defects. And so the Department of Health of South Africa was like, okay, wait a minute, we are not going to take that risk and introduce that drug to everyone in South Africa until we are sure that it's safe. So what we're doing at the moment is that we're waiting until March. We're waiting to see if any other babies in Botswana are born with the defect, the spinal cord defect. If a single other baby is born with that defect, then South Africa won't be introducing that drug.
Oh, okay.
We're independent now. We're all holding our hands because I love the new drug. I love it. It's beautiful. It's like a Bentley of ARVs. So we're just waiting and praying to God. We open to the Hambagatle. And if everything goes well, from April onwards, we'll be doing a phased-in approach where we're slowly changing people from efavirenz to dolutegravir.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, as an HIV/AIDS expert, what is your take on the debates concerning disclosure as well as the criminalization of HIV transmission?
Okay, so I love these questions. So the first thing around disclosure, so I'm very clear about disclosure, that you only need to tell a person whom you're exchanging bodily fluids with about your HIV status. And I mean this from the bottom of my heart. So I don't think there's any need for you to tell your children or to tell your parents about your HIV status, only because HIV is no longer the death sentence that it was. Right? Because we come from a time where there was no medication. If you tested positive for HIV, you knew that you were going to die. But we now live in an era where the medication is so advanced, everything is so advanced that you can live a long, healthy, happy life with HIV. So there's no need to be alarmist and to tell members of your family or friends or make some huge announcement about your status, unless you really want to, okay? But if you're sleeping with someone, it's important for them to know that you're living with HIV. Not because you're scared to infect them, because if you're on treatment, you won't infect them, but only because, you know, it's something important for them to know. Around the criminalization of HIV, again, that's something that I'm completely opposed to, especially from a human rights perspective. I think we're at an age where if you know when someone is interested in you in that way, so as adults, we should be having talks about sex way before the sex happens. And part of the talks will include, hey, have you tested for HIV? Do you mind if we go and test together? And then you find out, you know, then you can figure out who's who. So I'm totally opposed to criminalization of HIV. I think countries that do that are really violating people's human rights.
Wow. And for the last question that I have for you this afternoon, I understand that HIV is no respecter of persons. It does not care what your race, nationality, ethnicity, religious belief, level of education, socioeconomic status, whether you are bigger in the streets or the top earning celebrity of 2018. It does not care. But when I look at the statistics and try to study, analyze and understand, I am baffled by the numbers. And hence, I would like to pose to you that although HIV affects us all, right now in 2018 in the Republic of South Africa, I submit that in terms of prevalence, it is mostly affecting the young black woman. Would I be correct in making that claim?
So you're correct in that it does primarily affect women. And just purely based on the demographics of our country, it primarily affects black women. One thing that you guys don't know is that there's a large population of other races who are living with HIV. We just don't have access to those statistics because those people are primarily seen in the private sector, right? So the Department of Health cannot ask Discovery to release their stats and tell us how many white people are living with HIV and are HIV positive. If that could happen, that would give them a better picture, a more balanced view of HIV in this country. Right.
That's
and I think the media only has public sector stats to go by. So white people are forgiven for thinking that abantu bamnyama kuphela bane HIV. Kanti it's far from the truth. As long as you're sexually active, you are at risk of HIV infection. I happen to work in a predominantly white HIV practice on some days. So obviously most of the patients that I see with HIV are white. But again, it's that sabo asiko available to the media and so on.
And why is that?
Oh, well, look, private sector patients, I mean, their stats, the medical aides are not forced to supply their stats to the Department of Health. I wish they were, because then it would give a much more balanced picture of everything in our country.
Absolutely.
Dr. Cindy has uncovered and brought forth such vital information, such as how the breakup of the family structure in Southern Africa has played a major role in the prevalence of HIV, but also the importance of going for regular testing. Even as someone who is not sexually active, know your status.
Listening to Law Focus? Connect with VowFam 88.1 on Twitter and Facebook. Be your own lawyer. Law Focus, handing you your rights.
A man in the United States has been handed two 15-year imprisonment sentences following his non-disclosure of his HIV-positive status when he had sex twice with his partner. Of course, on both occasions, he did use a condom and did not infect her. This is where the debate around criminalization stems. The accused argues that although he did not disclose his status, he is and was working with his doctors at the time to ensure that he protects his partner at all times. It has been argued that the issue of criminalization is about a misunderstanding of how HIV is transmitted. Important information to take note of is that it cannot be transmitted from saliva when kissing, biting, or spitting. It is also undetectable. It is rare that it will be transmitted in a single sexual act. Most importantly is that it's not possible to establish proof beyond reasonable doubt that one person has infected another, even with the most advanced phylogenetic scientific tools. And this is essentially where the whole dilemma about criminalizing comes from. The issue of criminalization of HIV transmission in South Africa goes as far back and even prior to 2001, when the South African Law Commission reported on its potential criminalization. The criminalization of HIV transmission is a rather seemingly punitive measure or approach to preventing the spread of HIV. 72 countries have HIV-specific criminal laws. Some of these countries include Canada, the United States of America, Australia, Zimbabwe, and Namibia. South Africa, however, does not have any specific law on HIV transmission, although, of course, the South African Council of Churches suggested in 2006 that if you are sexually active and do not disclose your status to your partner, you could potentially be liable for rape. This would also apply even to sexual partners who are already HIV positive. Although we do not have any specific law on HIV transmission, we do have laws that ultimately protect each citizen of this country. And at the core of these laws are human rights. Let us remind each other of these laws that protect HIV positive persons. Although we may not exhaust all of them, it is important that we do notice, particularly the ones around the issues of disclosure and the right to privacy.
Persons with HIV or AIDS have the duty to respect the rights, health, and physical integrity of others, and to take appropriate steps to ensure this when necessary.
Insurance companies may not unfairly refuse to provide an insurance policy to any person solely on the basis of HIV and AIDS status.
HIV-positive people have a right to their confidentiality and to keep their status private.
No HIV-positive person may not be restricted in terms of the movement or have their rights to make their own decisions, such as about marriage and children, taken away from them.
Well, prisoners with HIV/AIDS should have access to the kind of special care that is equivalent to that enjoyed by other prisoners with other serious illnesses.
No health professional may disclose the status of an HIV patient to his or her partner, even when the partner is not sexually protected. That is, no condoms are used.
It is unlawful and illegal to disclose someone's HIV status without their consent, because it is also unlawful to threaten to disclose or blackmail a person to either disclose or keep their status.
I have the right to choose when and if I want to be tested.
Listening to Law Focus? Connect with VowFM 88.1 on Twitter and Facebook. Be your own lawyer.
In 2013, the Pretoria High Court ruled HIV exposure as an attempted murder. The defendant in this case had unprotected sex with his unsuspecting girlfriend, knowing his status, but of course not disclosing. He was given 6 years in prison. It is important to note that the man in the case who had unprotected sex with someone without first disclosing his status was an HIV/AIDS counselor himself. It would be very interesting to find out, perhaps, if it was someone who had not been an HIV/AIDS counselor, would the outcome of the matter be different? Joining us to speak to Millicent Ndweni about some of these matters of discrimination and disclosure is the Director of Healthcare and Life Science Law at Worksmen's Attorneys, Mr. Neil Kirby.
Thank you, Mr. Kirby, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's start with our first question, being that in 2013 we had a case of a Mr. Peary, who was an AIDS counsellor. He was found guilty of having unprotected sex with his unsuspecting partner without disclosing his status, and subsequently sentenced to 6 years imprisonment. Now, had he not known, or rather had he not been an HIV/AIDS counsellor, could we have expected a different outcome of the case?
Well, I don't think so, because I think knowing your status is definitely universal knowledge from the point of view of what it is that you can or can't do with an unsuspecting partner or somebody that you have decided to have intercourse with. But obviously, as a counsellor, you are even more aware. So I can understand that the particular sentence was maybe a bit harsher, but with the amount of information in circulation these days about HIV and AIDS, it's very difficult for one to feign ignorance in the face of that information. And I don't think that at this point in time there may be a different outcome for that type of scenario.
That's okay. That clears it up. Now, if you do know who may have infected you with the HIV virus, what recourse does one actually have?
Well, you probably have two sets of recourse. One would be in criminal law. You could lay a complaint with the South African Police Services. The other may be in delict, or our law dealing with damages, where if somebody has inflicted harm on you and you suffer a loss as a result, or you incur costs that you otherwise wouldn't have incurred but for that harm, you may very well have a legal remedy to sue that person for money.
Have we had actually successful claims in that regard?
Not to my knowledge. I think that the focus has been on criminal outcomes rather than on civil remedy outcomes.
Okay. Now, as an expert in the field of healthcare and law, is it possible to truly verify who may have infected you with the HIV virus?
Very difficult to prove, especially if you have multiple partners. You would have to almost require each of those partners to provide you with blood results, as at the time that you may have been involved with that person. from a physical point of view. And if they refuse to do so, there's very little that you could actually do about forcing them to provide you with those results. It's obviously very sensitive medical information, people are not necessarily compelled to provide other people in the absence of legal action with medical information.
Yeah, it does sound like a very difficult case to handle, I have to be honest. Now, as we're talking about disclosure, there is this lived reality of HIV-positive people at times being blackmailed by those who are close to them. So, for instance, your spouse blackmails you by threatening to reveal your HIV status if you perhaps are no longer interested in the relationship, or even vice versa, if you reveal, you will, you may lose certain benefits in the relationship or whatever. Now, how far do these issues of your confidentiality and disclosure extend?
Well, confidentiality is a pretty absolute concept in medical or healthcare law. I mean, your medical records are required to be kept confidential by your healthcare practitioner, and there are only very certain circumstances where that information may be sent from your healthcare practitioner to perhaps another healthcare practitioner. So confidentiality remains a top priority from a South African legal perspective. In terms of disclosure, you aren't required to disclose to anyone other than perhaps your partner concerning your medical condition, and that wouldn't necessarily only relate to HIV. If there was any STD, would require some degree of disclosure in terms of both responsibility and just common decency to your partner. But once again, you can't compel someone to disclose all of the information at the outset if they don't want to. And you certainly can't require them to sign a form or a consent or whatever the case is, especially if you're in a relationship. So it makes life relatively difficult to manage. And also you have to be in a position where preferably you use the necessary protections when having sex. And if you can have a discussion with your partner prior to any sexual intercourse, that should really happen on the basis of hopefully some honesty and some decency.
Okay. Now, I mean, I agree with you that confidentiality really is a big issue. And sometimes, maybe I'm wrong, but sometimes medical staff might disclose your consent, your status without your consent. These are all illegal acts, of course. We've already spoken about even threatening to disclose it's wrong because, it's blackmailing. Now, what recourse do people have if they do find themselves in those kind of situations that I've just outlined? Where do they go to for help? And what are the time frames in terms of the law for dealing with these kinds of lawsuits?
Well, look, if we're talking about a crime, which is really what blackmail or extortion would amount to, then your remedy would lie with criminal law and the police services. And if you're in the position where you're being extorted or you're being blackmailed, so to speak, because of your HIV status by someone near and dear to you, I mean, it's a rather unfortunate set of circumstances, but it is one that I think the law would be able to remedy. It wouldn't be easy. It would be incredibly awkward. But it would be something that that criminal law would recognize as having direct legal consequences.
And now, okay.
If one wanted to then take matters further, it would be with the police services. Albeit then, I understand that the person sitting with a particular medical condition may then be faced with having to disclose their condition to a policeman or policewoman. But I think that in circumstances where you are the victim of a crime, I think you should be able to exercise your rights on that basis.
Well, these are very complex issues. How do we then also now deal with people who do not have capacity, people who are perhaps underage or persons with mental illness, and discussing issues of consent for HIV testing, issues of non-disclosure, the potential criminalization for HIV transmission? Where do these people who might not have capacity fit in within this debate and discussion?
Well, let's start with children. Children can give consent to a medical procedure if they are capable of understanding the consequences and are able to consent themselves. So a child, irrespective of their age, within reason, would be able to say yes or no to a medical process or a medical procedure. Where that child is unable to do so due to age or due to another particular circumstance, that child's guardian or parent would be able to do that on their behalf. When it comes to people who are mentally challenged, the legislation recognizes how consent is to be provided, both in terms of the Mental Health Care Act as well as the National Health Act. So one would follow legal processes in order to secure that consent.
And in the final question, we know that there are significant strides that have been made by the international community concerning HIV research. What are your last encouraging words that you would like to say about some of these progresses?
I think we've come a long way as a society ourselves, both in terms of our recognition of the problem that we have with how HIV and AIDS was originally dealt with in this country, to a point now where we as a society are grappling with that issue and we're trying to deal with it as best we can and within the limited resources that we have. But I think that South Africans are aware, South Africans are proactive, and I think that from an international perspective, whilst we may have been lagging quite badly at some point, I think we are shoulder to shoulder with our international peers.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Mr. Neil Kirby, who is the Director of Healthcare and Life Sciences Law at Worksmith Attorneys. We appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you very much.
I think the information that Neil has just given us really outlined that be safe, because proving that you were infected by a particular person will be painstakingly difficult. If that person refuses to reveal the medical information, which is their right because it is confidential, you may find yourself in a bit of a fix.
I think what we can gather from Neil's conversation with Millicent is that you have to be safe, because proving that you were infected by a particular person can be quite challenging if the accused refuses, of course, to reveal his medical information, which is their right, as it is confidential. It does become very, very tricky after that.
Bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
As we highlighted some of the notions concerning criminalization, it seems the call to criminalize HIV stems from its belief that it will decrease the spread of HIV. However, the reality is HIV will not decrease because of a law. It will decrease because of other multiple reasons, including our own internalized individual behavior towards sex and sexuality, as well as the proper availability and distribution of condoms. And of course, this also includes the distribution of female condoms. And of course, taking responsibility of our own health, and that includes knowing your status. As we contemplate tonight's show, we need to consider some of the major human rights related to HIV programs, which as a society, we need to continue to foster, and that includes stigma and discrimination reduction. We also need to monitor and reform laws, regulations, and policies relating to HIV. We need to consider human rights training for healthcare workers and reduce gender-related discrimination. If you need any further information or any sort of help regarding HIV/AIDS, feel free to contact the National HIV/AIDS Helpline on 011-715-2000 or visit their website for more details on www.aidshelpline.org.za. From our producer Simba Honde, our technical producer Kutlwane Serame, as well as our Law Focus researchers Sesetu Zingelwa, Millicent Ndiwene, Siyabonga Mota, and myself Veronica Makhwadi, thank you so much for tuning into Law Focus tonight.
Law Focus, handing you your rights. Law Focus Podcast.